Support for Pray Public is provided by the Bush Foundation, investing in great ideas and the people who power them. Introducing the recipients of the 2024 Bush Fellowship. Learn more about the 2024 Fellows at bushfoundation.org/fellows.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein in our Fargo studio with my co-host, Ashley Thornburg.
Hello.
Good afternoon, Ashley. In the second half of today's show, we'll have a preview of this weekend's 32nd annual Missouri River Bluegrass Festival, and we'll also have another edition and one of your great interviews with Rick Guillon. That's Prairie Plates.
But we are going to start today learning about the North Dakota Council on the Arts. They have a new executive director. Jessica Christie grew up the child of two artists in North Dakota. She spent a lot of time working in big cities, like in the Chicago art scene, and she is so excited to be back home in North Dakota. Her imagination is as big as the sky around here. And so she joins me now to talk about her plans for where she'd like to take the Council on the Arts. Jessica, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate you being willing to chat about the arts in North Dakota.
Congratulations on the new position.
Thank you so much. Yeah, it's really exciting to think about coming home.
Art certainly runs in the family. And like you said, coming home, this is your opportunity. You've spent some time in Chicago and in bigger cities working with arts, a very different feel, I would imagine. But the background here, growing up and doing the arts in a state like North Dakota.
I am a child of two artists myself. I was born and raised in North Dakota. Both of my parents met while they were, they met while they were in art school. I was raised on a farm just outside of Valley City, a dairy goat farm, in fact, where my parents both worked as working artists. So that's the world I was born into. And I continued it, in college, went to Valley City State, got an art degree, and then I got my MFA from UND.
And then since you have been very active in the arts community, working in Jamestown at the Arts Center, working in Chicago, let's talk about what keeps you motivated and working, because it is often very much a sort of passion project. What gets under your skin about the artistic endeavors that you most enjoy?
Certainly, going to school and getting a couple art degrees is one thing, but then to just dive in and being a working artist is kind of, you become a jack of all trades. You have to be a business person. You have to create. You have to do PR for yourself. So I've had to do that throughout my career. The thing that really, really motivates me is collaborating and working with other artists, which is a big reason that motivated me to want to take on this role. I moved to Chicago, working here for about 9 years, and the city is amazing. It's an amazing city. It's an amazing cultural city, but I kept feeling like I wanted to be working with the communities back home. I miss the places that shaped me, and that's something that just kind of, I kept coming back to, and now I have a young daughter, and I want her to know, what rural America is, what North Dakota is, what the prairie is, what the big, beautiful sky is. Getting back home and working with the communities is really what motivates me, and collaborating with other creatives and those who are interested in being creative is really exciting to me at this point in my career.
This place that shaped you, some people could easily just go on the drive, from Bismarck to Fargo and just say it's flat. Other people see expansiveness and imagination and the ability to kind of connect dots and create in the brain. Obviously, you're in that second category here. When you say that this place shaped you and your art, give us some more details there.
So funny that you mentioned the drive between Bismarck and Fargo. I made that drive actually while I was interviewing for this role, and it was during the snow geese migration. And I won't put Chicago down. Again, it's a beautiful city. We have a really wonderful forest preserve parts of the city. There's a lot of greenery, but it's just not what the prairie is. And so I was able to take this drive by Gackle and Jamestown and see the snow geese migrating. And my young daughter was with me. And I was like, look at all the birds. That's just, you know, a little bit of magic that we don't get here in this urban environment. So yes, that's one thing. But coming back to the people who are really passionate, and in North Dakota, an individual makes a massive difference in the ecosystem because of the population. And that to me is really, really powerful. So every individual in North Dakota, in the culture and the arts, matters. That's exciting to me. It's exciting to not only be on the raw prairie and see the snow geese, but also to connect with the people who are making real change. Not saying that that doesn't happen in every space. You know, everyone who's working in the culture and arts, they're doing a lot of work. A lot of people are, they have a lot of hats that they have to wear. But specifically, I see it in the folks in North Dakota who have to wear so many hats and do so much to, you know, bring the arts to their spaces or to their schools. And that's just so exciting to me. And I've missed those connections. I've missed making those real, intentional connections with the people of my home state.
We're visiting today with Jessica Christie. She is the newly appointed executive director of the North Dakota Council on the Arts. Jessica, what are your big plans?
Ooh, that's a tough question. you know, I think one thing I'm onboarding now with the current executive director, Kim Conico, but she's been giving me so much amazing information. There's a few things that I really want to do. I think that we have a lot of stories to tell. We are the holder of stories for the arts in North Dakota, and we need to tell those stories. You know, we're humble people in the state of North Dakota, and we need to share the wins and the excitements and the great things that our communities and our organizations and our artists are doing. That's going to be a focus of mine. You know, I really want to listen and hear what people are doing. I've been away for a decade. I'm excited to hear what people are up to. You know, I'm excited to get the phone calls and to have the conversations and hop on a Zoom meeting or whatever anybody needs so that I can hear what they're up to. I'm also really passionate about supporting young creatives, and especially voices who may not otherwise have had the opportunity to have creative outlets or have opportunity to take a class, take a dance class or, you know, a visual arts class or a music class. I'm going to be doing the best that I can do to get those young folks in places so they can be creatives and they can continue their creative path and start it as early as they want to keep making our street more creative and more artful and more just full of culture.
Jessica, what do you think are the most common misconceptions about what an arts council is and does?
I think, one, if anybody does know about North Dakota Council on the Arts, they probably think about our granting programs, which is a big part of what we do, right? You know, we receive money from both North Dakota, the state, and we receive money from the National Endowment for the Arts. So they think about us as how we grant money out, which certainly is something that we do. But we do a whole lot more than that. You know, we are currently in the process of having a very large place-making program called Arts Across the Prairie, which is bringing large-scale art installations to each region, each of the 8 regions in North Dakota. We have an amazing folk arts and traditional arts program. We have so many programs that are happening. And again, that goes back to, we've got to tell our story. We've got to tell everyone's story. We need to really dig into our storytelling abilities so we can make sure that everyone knows what's going on. But we have a lot of conversations internally about, we just need to make sure that people know that we're here. We're a resource. You know, we're a state agency that's a resource for those who want to bring the arts to their community or who want to learn about the arts or maybe support the arts. We just need to be visible. And I think that that's maybe, you know, one of the biggest misconceptions that, wow, North Dakota has a state arts agency. We do, and we're here, and we want to support you, and we want to be here for you and help you grow in your creative endeavors.
We're visiting today with the new executive director of the North Dakota Council on the Arts, Jessica Christie. And Jessica, you've spent a great deal of this interview talking about the wonderful opportunities, really struck by something that you said earlier, which is that in a rural place, one individual makes an incredible difference. There are, though, challenges of being in a rural place, or maybe even just the challenge of the fact that it's a large geographical spread. You know, it can take hours and hours and hours to drive across this. What do you think are some of the areas that are the most opportunity for growth here?
We have a lot of supporters in the arts. I think we need to lean on our community members who are out there who want to, you know, support in a way that might not fit into these grant programs or might not fit into the big sculptures that are going up. But maybe it comes from a conversation that can be had. I think that that's another beautiful thing about the culture of North Dakota is we make personal relationships, and they can happen anywhere. They could start at the grocery store. They could start at the corner store, the single gas station, you know, in the town. Or I think it's leaning on our people to be our voice and to listen to what people are saying. And you're right. It's a vast state. And I know that the corners probably sometimes feel that, hey, we're out here too. We're, you know, Fargo's the big city and Grand Forks and Bismarck. And I just want to say I see all of you, and I can't wait to have those conversations and meet up with you wherever it may be, whether it's the town hall or the gas station, or, you know, I haven't had a slice of gas station pizza in a long time, or there's places that make really good sandwiches. Like, I'll meet you there. Let's have a conversation. And I think it's just leaning on the people who want to support and want to kind of maybe be a connector. You know, North Dakota is made up of connectors. It's a challenge, but we got a really great we just have wonderful people who are willing to make those relationships, and I'm excited about that.
Jessica, early on in this interview, you talked about having to promote yourself and have that business mind. And oftentimes people think that if you have an artistic mind, you don't have a business mind, kind of that left brain, right brain thing. One, kind of how accurate do you find that to be within yourself? And then two, like, talk about your approach to having to employ those sort of methods on a much larger scale. You are not promoting yourself anymore. You are promoting all of the arts in the entire state.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that misconception about artists just being, you know, oh, they never on time, they, you know, they're just kind of flighty is something that rubs myself and honestly most artists I know the wrong way, because we really do have to do it all. It's a career choice that is all encompassing, and you have to kind of, you're not usually taught it in school, I'll say that much. But certainly, I mean, I think my experience as a visual artist, you know, showing in galleries and museums for the past 15, 18 years has primed me for, you know, not really being afraid of tackling anything that may be in my path at the council. You know, it's there's so many things that pop up when you're an artist, whether it's, oh, your piece was damaged in a museum and you've got to figure out how to fix it from afar, or we need a press release yesterday. You know, and you know, maybe 21-year-old me had never written a press release. So then I had to figure out how to write a press release. It's being flexible and open and willing to learn and willing to grow. Having to do that over and over and over, you know, kind of takes the fear out of those new experiences and those new environments. I really love the challenge of a new experience and new programs and new just challenges in period. It's great to think about how I can creatively problem solve. I guess being an artist has taught me how to just tackle a situation and really dive in and say, hey, we're going to be creative and see where we come out. But it's not a fear-based situation. It's really exciting to me to think about all the problem solving that's going to be ahead of me in this role.
Did you ever struggle with leaning in to calling yourself an artist?
You know, that's a really interesting question. I see it a lot in a lot of artists. You know, I hear the words, but I'm not quite at this level yet, or I'm not really an artist yet. I am so lucky that I was born into an art family. And so being an artist was just kind of a part of who we were. It was never questioned. So I'm very privileged in that sense, but I hear it from my artist friends all the time. And certainly the identity of an artist is always changing because we're always growing. We're always making new things, changing the way that we, our perspective on the creative, our creative paths. So it's really easy to kind of have that identity crisis. And I can say that that's happened in my art career many times. But you know what? An artist is somebody who wants to be creative, who seeks creativity, and it's a spectrum. And I encourage anybody who is interested in the arts and wants to be creative to embrace the term artist, because it's not a specific term that only fits few. It fits everybody. And you know what? We're born as artists. We're born to be creative. We're born to be visual human beings. And at some point, that kind of falls away for some of us. But I think that it's important to foster that and to keep supporting, the artist within us. Because even if we're not practicing or making or dancing or performing, being a supporter is equally as valuable. So let's foster that little artist that's born into all of us and keep calling ourselves artists. It's not this term that's elite, I'll say that much.
You know, we're talking about supporting the artists, but let's put the onus on the art consumer here too. I'm looking at a spreadsheet here posted by an artist, artwork sales here, asking price $1,200, material and costs $150, framing and shipping $200, gallery gets a 50% commission, comes down to a profit of $250. Spent approximately 40 hours making this painting. That comes down to an hourly rate of $6.25. What do you want to say to people who say, you want me to pay what for that?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for breaking that down. I think that is an ongoing struggle with makers, with visual artists, with performers, with musicians. I always say, people aren't necessarily paying for the final product. They're paying for all that experience that person has gained as they have moved through their career. You could say the same thing about somebody in the trades. They have experience being a plumber or an electrician, and you call them because they're the expert. your toilet isn't working. You need an expert to fix it. And you're going to pay them what they charge, because you need your functioning plumbing, right? It's the same for the arts. You know, the arts are an integral, crucial part of who we are and our society to be a functioning whole entity. We need to pay the experts in their field for what they do. You know, and not everybody wants to purchase an expensive painting, and that's fine. But think about going to a performance or supporting young performers as they're emerging in their careers. They're learning to be the experts, and that's a valuable support as well. And, you know, their work and their labor in their fields is valuable. So when you are buying that ticket to the play, or you're paying to see a musician, or you are buying a piece of art, think about it as, you know, it's a investment in that person's expertise. It's a final product, yes, and it should be there for us to enjoy, but you're really investing in that person and who they are, and who they are in our society and what they're giving to our society as well.
You're stepping into Kim Conoco's shoes. She held this position for 6 years. How do you describe her legacy?
You know, Kim is a really strong arts advocate. It's been so clear to me. I think I'm on day, oh gosh, I don't even know what day I'm in work. I'm a few weeks in, and Kim's passionate. And I'm so excited to step into a position where she has fearlessly fought for the arts in the state. She is just so passionate about making sure that artists have opportunities, that organizations are being supported, and that the arts are being brought to North Dakota. You know, growing up in a state where often you're kind of told, well, you can stay here or you can go off to the big city, was kind of, you know, how I felt as a young artist in the state. And I went off to the big city, and I really miss, I miss the creative communities back home. And that's, Chicago's again, it's a great city. I'm excited to get back, and I'm excited to continue to do the fight that Kim has been doing for 6 years. She's really kind of showing me that, you know, you've got to dive in, you've got to fight hard. But it's you're doing great work for these amazing organizations and people. She's really passionate, and I'm so thankful to be, I have her as a guide for a month here. It's been a wonderful introduction back into the state in the arts.
Jessica Christie, the new executive director of the North Dakota Council on the Arts. Thanks so much for joining us, and congratulations once again on the new position.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is Bird Note.
An evening baseball game isn't the only thing illuminated by the bright stadium lights. High in the air, countless flying insects are drawn to them. And those insects are a perfect snack for the game's avian attendees. Common nighthawks swoop with their wide mouths open to hoover up the flying insects under the lights, performing aerial stunts over the athletes on the ground. Common nighthawks belong to the nightjar family, a group of birds with long wings and big mouths that are adept at hunting in the air. Nighthawks have gray and brown feathers that help them blend in on the ground. In the sky, though, these birds stand out. Vertical white wing stripes glow bright even at dusk and dawn, when they're most active. To show off for potential mates, male nighthawks use a display called booming. They dive so that air makes a loud boom as it passes over their wings.
Hot dogs! Yeah, hot dogs!
The next time you're enjoying your snacks at the game, just know that the birds are enjoying theirs, too. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein. This episode is sponsored by 7-year-old Quinn Sedgley, who wants everyone to help birds and wildlife.
A preview of the 32nd Annual Missouri River Bluegrass Festival and Prairie Plates. That's coming up after this. Welcome back to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Well, Okay, it's June. In fact, it's the middle of June. That must mean it's time for the annual Missouri River Bluegrass Festival. In fact, the 32nd annual Missouri River Bluegrass Festival. My guests today are Jill Weiss and Juan Gelfi. They're with the group who puts on this wonderful festival every year. Am I right about the timing? Is it time again already?
It is time, everybody. Yes.
Welcome to Main Street, both of you. Where is the event again this year?
Well, the Cross Ranch State Park is a little bit northwest of Bismarck, maybe about 38, 39 miles. It is a state park right along the Missouri River. So it's about 12 miles out of Washburn, 12, 13 miles out of Center.
So we get to hear great bluegrass music. People can bring their chairs, bring their hats, maybe even bring their bug spray.
Yeah, I might do that.
Tell me what's going to go on and what are the times? When should people expect to be on hand?
Sure. So the festival this year is Friday and Saturday. Friday we start at 6:30 and Saturday we start at 10 o'clock in the morning. Both nights we're going to be going until the last band plays. Going to be around 10:30 at night. People can start coming in really Thursday night if they're camping. Bring their campers. The electric sites are all fully booked, but there is tons of overflow camping. And if you've ever been to one of these bluegrass festivals, I got to tell you, the fellowship, the camping, the campfires, the staying up at night playing the music is at least as much fun as watching some of these great bands. So get there early, get yourself a good campsite, bring your chairs, and make a weekend of it.
Sounds like a great weekend. We had great weather last weekend. Let's carry that good weekend weather through to this weekend, too.
It looks to be pretty good next weekend, the forecast, actually, so that's good.
What are tickets? Do you charge like at the door as people come in?
We do. First of all, I'll mention 16 and under are always free. We really encourage families to bring all the kids and the neighbor kids and, you know, kids they don't know. Just grab them off the street and bring them because it's so much fun. And then $15 on Friday night. And then on Saturday, it is $25 for the whole day. And then if you're coming Friday and Saturday, it's $35.
And we'll have plenty of tickets at the gate. This year, though, if you want to, you can buy tickets in advance. If you go to our Facebook page, which is Bluegrass Association of North Dakota, on the poster, there's a QR code and also a link to Eventbrite. And you can buy your tickets up front if you'd like to. There is a small service charge if you buy them ahead of time.
You have some workshops available for folks. What are those like?
Tell
me about them. Yeah.
You know, the workshops are really a lot of fun. And it's what you will see at a bluegrass festival around the country. A lot of education. Our two headline bands are going to be teaching on Saturday starting at 1 o'clock in the maintenance shop. So we'll have chairs set up and all the song sheets printed out. And they'll teach you a bluegrass song. And I mean, even if you have a banjo in a closet you haven't looked at for 20 years, you know, grab it out, bring an instrument, or you don't need an instrument either. You might come and just sing along with us and kind of get inspired, learning a couple of songs. I know there's going to be some workshops Friday night after the concert with John Andrus. And also, he's doing some detuning banjo workshop on Saturday afternoon. So there's always a little something going on, but the main headline bands will be teaching from 1 to 3, and that is absolutely my favorite part of the festival.
I just want to emphasize what an incredible opportunity it is, because these bands, some of these are some of the most well-known bluegrass musicians in the country right now, and being able to just sit, you know, 4 feet away from them and glean knowledge and information from them is just a privilege. It really is.
Tell us which bands will be on hand.
We've got 5 bands, and one of the things I'm most excited about is it's a great mix of bands with national and truly international reputations, and then some homegrown bands, some of our very own finest North Dakota bluegrass bands as well. The headliners are the High 48s. They're out of the cities. They're a slightly younger band with a slightly younger sound. One of my favorite things about them is they are a little bit genre agnostic. They don't mind throwing a little jazz in there, a little bit of blues in there, maybe some pop sounds as well. But at heart, they're a bluegrass band. They're just going to be a little bit more eclectic than some of the others you'll hear. And then we have a band called The Special Consensus, and this is something I'm really excited about. They've been around since the 1970s. About 60 musicians have cycled through that band and exist now as alumni of Special Consensus. But They are International Bluegrass Music Awards winners multiple times. They are multiple Grammy Award winners, and I just think we're incredibly lucky to have them here in North Dakota.
Mm-hmm. They love to come to our festival. We have another band from your part of the state, Craig, Kohlrabi Soup. I think they kind of base out of Fargo. Aaron, the fiddle player, kind of heads up that band, and their bass player is Joe Andrus. And Joe's parents, John and Arlene, started the Bluegrass Festival. So it's fun to see these young guys band up and get together and get a sound going. And I'm not sure where our, you know, this will be their first performance at the Cross Ranch at the festival. And so they're very excited, and they're probably playing a little bit in Minnesota as well, I think. So they're going to be fun. Kohlrabi Soup. Yeah. So we're all excited to hear them. We've got the Blue Stems coming from Elgin, and that is a brother-sister band. And I think the oldest is now 20, and the youngest is 7.
I've heard them perform, and they are very fun. A lot of fun.
Yeah, they're terrific, and it's been fun to see them progress and grow over the years, and their stage presence is like no other, and when they pick up their instruments, everyone pays attention because they're that talented, for sure.
And we've saved the best for last.
Sure you have. Yeah, come on.
I'm going to say my current favorite North Dakota bluegrass band. Now, I've not heard Kohlrabi Soup, so that might change, but right now, as of today, Cottonwood's playing, and that's Jill's band. And Cottonwood is a North Dakota bluegrass institution. They've been doing this for decades now, and if you've seen them, you know you're in for a treat, and if you haven't seen them, why not? You're past due to come and check out Cottonwood because they put on an incredible show every time.
How would each of you describe what bluegrass music really is? Give me a definition.
For me, it's storytelling, good harmony singing. People are amazing on their instruments. Some gospel music. I think it's really, I love it because you can have a lot of good singers up there, but then when they grab that fiddle or mandolin and take a break or a lead, we call it, now you have my attention because they're that talented to me.
And that is what there is to love about bluegrass on the micro level. Now, what I love about bluegrass on the macro level is that the history of bluegrass in many ways is the history of America. Bluegrass music is a gumbo of a lot of different styles. It's string music from Northern Europe and the British Isles. The banjo is a West African instrument. There's gospel music and call and response from people of the African diaspora in the American South. There's even elements of Native American music, Latin music. All of those find their way into bluegrass to make this incredible and potent stew that really is reflective of the history of popular music in America.
We are enjoying our conversation and having a little bit of fun with Jill Weiss and Juan Gelpe. They're telling us about the 32nd annual, you guys, that's a good run, Missouri River Bluegrass Festival at Cross Ranch State Park, June 14th and 15th. On Friday, June 14th, things get underway at 6:30 p.m. and Saturday at 10 a.m. How has this event evolved? What's changed over the years?
You know, I don't know that there's been a lot of change per se. Obviously, the bands that come through, we've been at the state park since the beginning, and I think our crowd has grown. Definitely age groups, you know, we're getting some younger folks to come. We're getting a lot of people that come for the first time. I think they're just trying new things, I guess, trying to figure out what is this music and maybe I should go. I think the festival has really, staples of it has maintained with workshops and late night jamming. And we have bands, Craig, that call us all year round who want to play our festival. And that's because we really have the most amazing hospitality that I've seen at a festival towards the bands.
You really try to make this family friendly. You don't allow smoking, alcohol, or pets in the concert area?
That is right. And there's an orange snow fence kind of set there before you come in the gate there. And a lot of folks that do have dogs when they're out camping, they'll sit out there with their dog and hang out, and that's fine. You know, and they can still hear really well, too.
Tell me why I should go if I've never been to a bluegrass festival. Why should I come?
Well, there are a couple of reasons. First of all, it's the music itself. If you've really never been to a bluegrass festival, if you haven't heard this stuff live, this is really walking a tightrope without a net. The beauty of bluegrass music is that it is virtually all improvised. Of course, we all rehearse, but when the person leading the song turns to you and says it's your turn to take a break, most of us are going to be improvising that break, and it's either going to work or it's not, and there's something exciting about watching that high wire act. The second thing about why this festival in particular is this festival is big enough to attract really some of the best talent, but small enough to be very much a family community event. People, you're going to see people you know there. If you don't know anybody there, you're going to meet people and you're going to make friends with them. The camping at night, playing around the campfires after the concerts are over, it's just very much a community that forms around these festivals. And this festival in particular has one of the best communities I've run across.
Are there any nearby accommodations if folks want to camp, but all of a sudden they can't get a camping slot?
You know, Bismarck Mandan is really not that far away, you know, maybe 38, 40 minutes. There is a little motel in Washburn called the Scottwood Motel that is available. The cabins and yurts are booked, of course, and that's a lot of our bands traveling are staying there. But overflow camping, a lot of people will go on the Cross Ranch State Park website and all the electric sites are full, but they don't have like all the overflow on there. And there really is a lot of places to camp overflow if you decide to just, you know, pitch a tent or, you know, something. Don't worry about making a reservation. You can call the park 794-3731 if you have questions, but we do have lots of room to accommodate for everyone.
And I don't think we've ever sold out the overflow camping.
No.
So bring your RV or a tent or, you know, whatever, and there will be room for you in the overflow.
Will there be food and drink around?
Yes, there will be. The Blue Stems have an ice cream truck. And
like
it's
that.
Really, really good. They have some tasty treats there. And I think they make like some specialty lemonades and some coffees, I think. And then we have Kimmy's food truck out of Beulah coming, so she'll have some food. There's always Schwann ice cream bars in the visitor's center. And, of course, again, Washburn's about 13 miles away, and we have several restaurants right in Washburn if you want to head. Or bring a cooler and a loaf of bread and some peanut butter or whatever. You won't really have much time to eat because it's so much fun listening to the concerts and then going to the jam afterward, too.
Joe Weiss and Juan Galpe, they've been inviting us all to come to the 32nd Annual Missouri River Bluegrass Festival, just 40 miles north of Bismarck, set in the woods of Cross Ranch State Park. It's June 14th and 15th. Jill and Juan, best wishes, good luck. I think it's going to be a great event. Thanks for joining us on Main Street.
Thank you, Craig.
Craig, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
I like bagels.
Have some salad.
All I eat is pizza.
Eat some barbecue.
Applesauce and some nice red beets.
Who is hungry? I know I am, and I'm pretty sure Ricky on is.
Always hungry.
Always hungry, and it is time for Prairie Plates. And this week you want to talk about sausage and meat shops.
Yes, this will be the worst show ever.
Oh.
WURST, worst.
Oh, but ching. Bratwurst, sausage worst. There's got to be other worsts out there.
All delicious.
So delicious that the city of Fargo just bought 7,000 pounds of sausage?
Yes.
What's happening?
The good citizens of Fargo last Friday bought 7,000 pounds of Wishick sausage from Stan Supermarket.
Okay, not the city. This is like literally how much the people of Fargo are. This was not a sausage event.
No.
Oh, my word. Okay, well, that's a lot.
That's a lot of sausage. And Stan Supermarket from Wishick has a mobile trailer. They're driving around the state of North Dakota this summer. I would suggest to them go to Western Minnesota as well and hit up the Lakes region, but they're selling a sausage like hotcakes. And yeah, 7,000 plus pounds last Friday. There's other reports out there that say 12,000 pounds. So it's kind of beginning to be a tall tale. You know, one of those fishing type stories. Yeah. But
well, what is it about this particular sausage? Like, you hear in North Dakota things like the sausage triangle. They're coming from Wishick, Napoleon, from Ashley, the town, not me.
Well, Ashley and Ashley, that could be interesting. Go get some sausage there. But yeah, I mean, German-Russian country, Tri-County Alliance, that's that sort of thing. There's also good sausage, I hear, in Column, Napoleon, Ashley. We posted on the Prairie Public Facebook page a shop in Zeeland, North Dakota. That was from 2016, but we reposted it. It was from the Gutes Essen series we did. But that got a lot of likes. But yeah, Zeeland, North Dakota. There, that area of the state really has bragging rights, I'll honestly say, about their German-style sausage. You know, there's...
What makes something German-style?
It's the spices. It's, you know, a bratwurst is going to have some different things like nutmeg, mace, that sort of thing.
Nutmeg.
Yeah. Breakfast sausage has a little sage, some white pepper, black pepper, that sort of thing. And then this Wishick fry sausage, I think, is special because of the garlic. I think there's some heavy use of garlic in there somewhere, probably some onion powder, garlic powder, black pepper combo that just people love it. So
yeah, I know my husband's from Langdon and he's always getting stuff from the Langdon locker up there when somebody's coming through town or when he's going home.
The Langdon locker,
people are loyal to their sausage places.
Yeah, the Langdon locker sausage is quite popular in Fargo here with the at family fair you can pick it up. But yes, that's another famous one, Langdon Locker, for sure.
Where else are people going around and getting, you know, finding their meat loyalty? I don't know. I don't even know how to phrase this question, Rick.
These communities in North Dakota, Western Minnesota, are very proud of their meat shops, butcher shops. And so there's a good one in just about every kind of mid-sized, especially in the larger communities, but mid-sized. But I think the real famous ones in North Dakota are going to be Butcher Block Meats in Mandan, L&M in Grand Forks. They make some Czech-style sausage. Prime Cut Meats in Fargo, Meats by John and Wayne in Fargo, Valley Meat Supply in Valley City, that's a popular one. And then the Wurst Shop in Dickinson, and that's where I kind of got that little...
W-U-R-S-T.
Yes, and I need to try the one in Carson, North Dakota. I hear that they make good sausage, beef sticks, that sort of thing. So, and then there's a unique one in Moorhead that's actually woman-owned called She Said Butcher Shop, and she does these neat kind of weekly meat bundles and stuff like that and is really fun to talk to. So, yeah, I mean, there's just a lot of really fun things to try out there, and people are proud of it.
So talk to us about being a wise consumer at a specialty shop. Most of my experience with butcher shops is in movies, people who know exactly what they want and they argue with the butcher and all these things. And I have never, ever done that. Is that how it's supposed to go?
I don't know if I'd argue with a butcher because they have a lot of very sharp knives.
Well, that's fair. Yeah.
But, yeah, I don't know. It seems like prices have been going up not only at the grocery store but in butcher shops too. And it's just kind of watching the weekly specials. A lot of times they have these weekly specials or bundles where you can get good deals. But, yeah, like things like beef sticks and sausage have really gone up recently, and I think it's just kind of a COVID, post-COVID thing, unfortunately, and maybe prices will come back down. Mm. But, yeah, I mean, but you're going to pay for quality. It's homemade. It's made by people you know and trust.
Yeah.
And that sort of thing. And I think for me as kind of a an expert eater, maybe, a food enthusiast.
Do you have that on your business card yet?
I like knowing where my stuff comes from and those local things. So, yeah. Yep.
Well, and then cooking it.
Yeah, that's an interesting thing because you really need to understand that some of these sausages are already fully smoked or cooked, kind of the same thing there. And then some are partially smoked and cooked, and they usually say, you know, be sure to cook this sausage. And then some is just is raw. And I think Langdon Locker, from what I can remember last time I made it, is actually raw. So you do need to cook those things all the way. And then around this area, for some reason, people cook ring sausage in like a fry pan or a saute pan with, I don't know, about a half an inch of water or something in it. And I used to do this in a lid.
Yeah. My husband learned this from his dad.
It's a generational thing, but to me, it does not give good flavor at all. It's like you're poaching this sausage. And so even if it's frozen, I like to roast it in the oven and not too hot, because if it is frozen, you're probably going to get, you know, a middle that's raw. But at a temperature, usually it's about 350 degrees. I can throw in a ring of deer sausage, a ring of whatever sausage from, you know, a local butcher shop that's frozen for about 20, 25 minutes, and it's good. The skin gets
a
little...
You cook it straight from frozen?
Yeah.
Okay.
And like I said, you don't want to cook it...
Time saver.
It is, and you don't have to cook it like at 450. Don't cook it too hot, but I've noticed 350, 325, it cooks nicely. The skin gets crispy. It kind of caramelizes a little bit, so...
I've been doing the cook it in beer instead of water, and then maybe you can, then I actually cut it into small slices and cook it in a really buttered cast iron pan, but I'll try it just roasting.
I like your style.
All right. We check in with Ricky on once a week. Thanks, Rick.
Thank you.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public.
North Dakota Native American Essential Understanding Number 7 is about Native identity. It states, individual and communal identity is defined and supported by shared Native languages, kinship systems, Teoshpaye, clan structures, traditional teachings, values, sacred laws, and ceremonies. A continuum of tribal identity, unique to each individual, ranges from assimilated to traditional lifestyle. There is no generic American Indian. In this episode of Dakota Datebook, we'll listen to Debbie Petra, enrolled member of the Turtle Mountain Band of the Chippewa Nation, as she talks about the culture of the Turtle Mountain people.
Well, I think that we all have to recognize where we came from. And like I said, our culture is unique because we have the Chippewa, we have the French, we have the Cree. And so basically, we formed our own culture from the cultures that we had. And it became known as the Michif culture. Some people call it Métis because of Louis Riel and the Canadian movement that he had. But we all have to have our own identity. We all have to know where we came from. We all have to realize that we are an important part of a family, and that family leads back for generations. And who was in that particular lineal history is who we are. And if we can understand that, and if we can grow from that, and if we can accept that, then that's going to help us to be able to survive no matter where we go. It's always hard for a lot of our Native people to leave the reservation because they don't think that they will be accepted a lot of times. A lot of times they have... they're so close to family that they can't leave family.
I'm Sharla Stever. If you'd like to learn more about the North Dakota Native American Essential Understandings and to listen to more Indigenous Elder interviews, visit www.teachingsofourelders.org. Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, Funding for this series is from Humanities ND and the North Dakota Department of Public Instruction.
And that's it for today's Main Street. Thank you so much for joining us. Tomorrow on the show, Matt Olean reviews the movie Songs of Earth, and News Director Dave Thompson reflects on this week's North Dakota primary elections.
And in an excerpt from the Prairie Pulse television show, we hear from the Canadian Consul General, Beth Richardson, as she visits with host Matt Olean. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.